28 years ago this summer, I had a friend named Ed. Ed and I had only been in AA a couple of weeks. And one day, Ed said to me, how'd you happen to get into AA? I told him. And then I said, what about you? What brought you here? Well, he said, I'll tell you. It's a real strange story. He said, I was about half in the bag one night, and I got on a Lexington Avenue bus. He said, there were only about four people on it. But he said, brother, one of them, what a dish. She was the best looking gal I had ever seen in my life. And he said, despite the fact that there were many vacant seats, I went over and sat down in the seat next to this girl. And I tried to strike up a conversation with her, but I didn't seem to be getting very far. Said I suggested that we get off the bus and stop in a bar and have a drink, but she didn't respond to that. And I asked her for her phone number, and I thought I had punched the right key because she opened her bag up and got out a piece of paper and a pencil, and she wrote it down, folded it up, handed it to me. Just then the bus stopped and she got off. Said I wasn't too worried. After all, she had given me her phone number. Or so I thought, he said, until I opened it up. And he said, you know what it said? It said, if you want to stop drinking, stop down at 324 and a half West 24th Street. Well, he said, you know, I got thinking about that. And I couldn't figure it out. But he said that was a mighty good-looking girl, and I decided I'd do it. But he said I was really afraid to go down there by myself, so I got one of my buddies, and he said we went down there. And he said, here's where we came, right here to the club. And he said, I've been coming ever since, but I haven't seen that girl. About three nights later, I ran into Ed, and he said, I saw her. She's here. And so she was. And she was our next speaker, the first gal to come into AA and stay sober, Marty Mann. Marty.
Thank you, Bob. I haven't forgotten that episode. That guy thought he was being very funny on the bus. And the other people on the bus were laughing. But I saw his eyes. And his eyes were crying. And that's how I knew that he was an alcoholic. I didn't know he'd told that story to Bob. I haven't thought of it in a long while. What I told him was, I'll meet you tomorrow night at 8:30, and here's the address. I figured that would get him. Anyway, obviously I've been around AA a long while. But I have felt recently as if I'd had a second rebirth in AA. I think one's first coming into AA is a rebirth. And I'll go back to that in a little because that's what they asked me to do tonight. But for me, this past 4 months has been really a rebirth in AA thinking. 4 months ago, I fell and fractured my hip. I have been a somewhat active person. Good many of you know that because you've seen me in your various towns and cities and states, both in and out of this country. And I've been on the go for a good many years, and you know, I don't think I knew what it was to really stop. And on February 26th, I was stopped cold. There wasn't a thing I could do about it. And after the first few weeks of extreme pain and anxiety was over, I then settled down to what they told me was going to be a very long period of recovery before I could walk again, and walk, hopefully, quite normally again. You know, for somebody who has been on the go as much and as long as I have, that requires an almost total readjustment of your thinking, your feeling, your living. And where do you suppose I turned to find that? I had it all. I had the whole kit of tools right in my head, right at my hand. And I think beginning, at the very beginning of this, with the Serenity Prayer, and I really believe that for several weeks I said that several hundred times a day, and then going on to retest and retry and relive the 24-hour plan of one day at a time. And I'm still trying to do just that. I just don't believe that I could have managed all that. Helpless though I was, so that I couldn't just walk across the room and sneak a drink. But you know, and I know, that alcoholics, no matter how physically helpless they may be temporarily, can always find a way around that, if they really want to. And I haven't a doubt in the world that it could have been done. If that had been the way I had chosen to solve this particular problem. Even though it's a good many years, I'm a little surprised still that it didn't occur to me, or that it didn't become an urge of some sort, or that I didn't give even serious consideration to that particular way of solving my problem. I think there's a good reason why that's still surprising to me. I've heard other people during the day-to-day and talk about the fact that the minute they tasted alcohol, they knew that was for them. Well, that's the way I felt about it. The first time I ever had any, it was magic. Because it did solve my problems, whatever they were at the moment. Sheer magic. And just as soon as I found that out, then I was dependent on that magic, not only to solve any problem I had, but pretty soon to just solve being alive. And even though I didn't get into any serious trouble the first 10 years of my drinking, I drank enough to have got into trouble. I kind of think, I've felt this for a long while, that you have to be a little tougher, have a slightly better physique, and a little more determination than anybody else to even become an alcoholic, because you have to drink so much to do it. And the average person's body just won't take it. Of course, that's another reason I believe that our bodies are abnormal where alcohol is concerned, and I think that they handle alcohol abnormally from the minute we begin to drink it. How many of us, and I know a really large majority of those I've asked, how many of us were able to outdrink everybody else at first? We carried our liquor better than anyone did. We could drink more than anybody did. And, of course, we did drink more than anybody else. And this is normal. The trouble is that too many of us grew up in a period where that was considered not only normal, but a very fine and splendid thing to be able to do. And people patted you on the back and thought you were just great. It's one of the tragic myths, in my opinion, about drinking that is going to have to be destroyed if we're going to get people to look at this a little bit differently and perhaps take a little greater care when they begin to drink. But I didn't know anything like this. I had never heard the word alcoholic or the word alcoholism. Oh, I knew there were drunks. Those poor unfortunates that lived down on West Madison Street in my town, which was Chicago, called it the Bowery in New York, Skid Row and other places, but those were the drunks. They were all men, too. Didn't see any women down there. And I didn't know very much about those people. Certainly, they couldn't possibly have been anyone that I might have met or known or heard about. And it didn't really bother me very much. I didn't give it much thought. But the trouble was that when I began to drink and discovered the magic in it, and therefore developed the dependence on it that comes from finding the real solution to all your problems, you'd be silly if you didn't become dependent on it if it was all that wonderful. I didn't know where I was going. I didn't know what was happening. I didn't know where that road was leading. And when things began to change and began to go bad, I didn't know why, and I didn't know what was wrong. And I spent 5 years trying to find out. 5 years during which, having turned the corner into the trouble, I was shooting down like a shoot-the-shoot, just as fast as I could go, losing everything on the way. The typical pattern and the typical story of so many of us. But I wanted to know why. I was curious. I'd always been a curious person. Always tried to find out why things happened, and nobody could tell me. And it may seem unbelievable to some of the younger people in AA today, but in the 1930s, all through the 1930s, almost nobody knew the word alcoholic or the word alcoholism. Certainly no doctors knew it or used it. And when I finally began to go to doctors, they didn't call me any name. They just said, people like you. They were always talking to me about people like you. But who those people were or what they were, I didn't know. And I had come to the conclusion, and I think with a good deal of reason, that I was insane. I was doing things I didn't intend to do and didn't want to do, saying things I didn't mean, getting into all kinds of jams and fixes that I didn't want and didn't like. I didn't like myself that way at all. And here, all my life, I had been known as a willful person who got what she set out to get and did what she set out to do, and so I had up to now. And here in this area, I could make promises to myself over and over again. Not to anybody else, just to me. And I couldn't keep them. And this to me meant that something had broken in my head. So I did the obvious thing. I began to go to head doctors. Shrinks, we call them today. And not a one of them talked about my drinking at all. I talked about it to them because I explained that that was why I thought I was nuts. Oh no, they didn't think I was nuts. But they didn't tell me what I was. This went on for a year or so in England where I was living, and then finally I came back to this country because I thought if I'm going to be locked up for keeps, and it's clearly coming, let it be in my own country. And so I came back here, and for another year I knocked on the doors of the shrinks again. They never would take me on. I think they were all too honest. They really didn't know a thing about this. Well, could have been, too, that I was broke. don't think that was entirely it. Because some of those men I've known since, and they really didn't know, and they told me that they'd never had any success with people like you. And they were a little frightened of trying again. As a matter of fact, I think the whole situation was pretty hopeless for people like us until AA came along. In the years I'm talking about, when I was looking for help, AA had barely begun and nobody knew about it. Well, I was lucky in one way. I finally found a doctor who was willing to take me on, and he put me in a hospital, and there I was for 7 months. And I was determined that that wasn't enough, that I needed treatment for this, whatever it was that had broken in my head. He was another one who told me, you know, spoke of people like you. He did tell me that he thought I shouldn't drink, but he couldn't give me any good reasons for it. I wanted to learn how to drink again the way I used to, naturally. Doesn't everybody? I've rarely met anyone that didn't come here with that somewhere tucked away in the back of their mind as the real thing they were after. And for many people who come to AA, it's an appalling shock when they discover that that's not what they're going to get here. Nobody's going to teach them how to drink normally again. Nobody's going to help them become a social drinker. And they're going to have to swallow the very difficult fact that because they're alcoholics, they can never touch alcohol again. You know, I couldn't swallow that from the doctor. And even though my 7 months in the hospital was followed by another 15 months in a private sanitarium, and I was getting good treatment every day, and I was learning a great deal about myself, the things that made me tick, the things that were difficult for me, the reasons I had some problems. And that doctor was sensible enough to know that people like me couldn't drink. And he told me this. That was two of them. But here again, he couldn't tell me why. And I could not accept it from him. Because he didn't have a good, logical reason that could be proved to my skeptical mind. And so every now and then I'd try it out. And you can imagine what happened. I'd go into town, because I was permitted to, 7 or 8 times, and I'd come back all right. The 9th or the 10th time, I'd come back drunk. Now, I didn't set out to get drunk. Looking back, it was easy to see what I was doing. I was testing out my progress. Was I doing well enough? Was I learning enough about myself? Was I progressing in my treatment enough so now I could drink normally? And of course, I never could. And as I said, this was a hard pill to swallow. It got to the point where that good doctor told me that if it happened again, I would have to leave. I think you must remember that that was my last hope, that I had spent almost 5 years looking for help, and this was the first time that I had been getting any kind of help at all. At least they felt they were helping, they were trying to, and I too felt that this was the kind of help I needed. And yet, it was going to be all taken away, all for naught, if I got drunk again. Well, you don't think I never touched it, do you? I just took infinitely greater care. I didn't get caught when I got back. And this went on for another 4 or 5 months. And then one day my doctor sent for me. And he was at home sick. And he wanted me to come and see him. And I was very frightened, because I thought, this is it. Now I've had it, he's going to throw me out. And I went, and he was propped up in bed, and on the bedclothes he had a red cardboard cover manuscript. It's the only way I can describe it. And he said, I've just been reading this. It's written by some people like you. I guess he choked over the word even then. He couldn't say it. He said, they seem to have found an answer. And he said, maybe this will work for you. I want you to take this book and read it. And I took it with my heart very light because I hadn't been thrown out. And I went back to my room. And the title of this book was Alcoholics Anonymous. It was not in print, in hard covers. It was what they called a multilith copy, with cardboard covers and wire circles, you know, holding it together. And I started to read it with great excitement. The only trouble was that after a few pages, my excitement dropped. There were capital letters all over every page, and those capital letters were all G. And I wasn't ready for God. And I thought, too bad. It would have been so nice. And I read on a little bit, and I found a few things that I liked in it. I found one thing I liked very much that made sense to me. It talked about alcoholism being an allergy of the body coupled with an obsession of the mind. And that this allergy of the body, whatever it was, and they didn't know what it was, couldn't be changed. Once you developed it, you had it. It was irreversible, and that this was why you could never put alcohol into that body again. But you had an obsession of the mind that kept driving you to drink even when you didn't want to or didn't intend to. Well, I knew that. That had been happening to me for years. And that something could be done about. Well, I liked this. But then I began to read some of the things that could be done about it, and we were right back at this God bit. And I sadly had to put it aside and think, well, I wouldn't like these people. What they are, praying mantises or something. Mission stiffs that pray over you. You know, I had all kinds of notions of what this. So I began telling the doctor what was wrong with this book. And I fought it, and I picked it apart, and I complained about it. And this went on day after day, and he'd let me talk, and then he'd say, well, go on reading it. So I dragged my feet, and I read it just as slowly as I could. And while this kind of thing was going on over a period of some weeks, something happened to me that I had read in that book. I didn't connect it then. A crisis situation arose in my life for which I felt responsible. If I had not been in that particular place, if I hadn't been the way I was, this would not have happened. And yet there was nothing I could do about it. And I felt so badly about it and so angry about it. As a matter of fact, I felt ready to kill. I had never felt like that before. I was in my room and I'd been reading this damn book. And it was lying on the bed. And I started thinking about what I wanted to do in this situation, and I'd go right down to the town, and I'd buy two bottles, and I'd come back, and I'd get drunker than I'd ever been, and I'd tear that place apart. Well, I was showing that remarkable intelligence that all alcoholics have, where when we get angry, we pick up a sledgehammer and beat our own brains out. This is true. This is why we can't afford resentments. It's why we can't harbor anger, because we hurt ourselves when we do it. We don't act like normal people. We do it backwards. And that's what happened to me then. And I was lying there planning this and literally seeing red when my eye fell by mistake on this open book on the bed. And there was a line in that book that seemed to me to stand out as if it were in block letters, raised. And it read, we cannot live with anger. And that was the battering ram that knocked my resistance right down. And the next thing I knew, I was on my knees beside that bed. There was a big wet spot. I don't know how long I'd been there. Apparently I'd been crying. and I lifted my head into a sensation such as I'd never had before, of utter, total, complete freedom. It was on the third floor. It had been an attic, and my room was under the eaves, and there was a little window. And I looked out that window, and the sky had never looked that blue, and the grass had never looked that green, and I knew I could walk out of that third floor window and keep right on walking. I knew this. I was free. And in that freedom, my total and complete belief in God, I never used any other word, had come back. And the presence of God was in that room with me and had set me free. I knew all this. And yet the other side of my mind, the skeptical side, the intellectual side, if you like, was saying, now you really have gone nuts. Now you better go tell the doctor. So I went downstairs and I beat on his door and he came and took one look at me and he pushed the other patient out another door and said, come in, what happened? And I told him what had happened. And here again, I was lucky, if you want to call it luck, I don't. Because many doctors would have said, well, you've had an hallucination or something has gone wrong with you. Or they would have reserved judgment on the whole thing and not committed themselves one way or the other to me. But this man said, after asking me many questions, I do not think you are insane. I believe you've had an authentic spiritual experience. Now, he said, go back upstairs and finish that book. And I went upstairs and I picked the book up and started to read again at the beginning, and somebody switched books on me. It was a totally different book. It was the most wonderful book I'd ever read in my whole life. I sopped it up like a sponge. I read it through at a sitting, and then I started all over again, and I read it again. And I was on cloud nine, believe me, for quite a while. I walked around, and everyone looked beautiful. And everything looked beautiful. There was just one problem I had. My doctor wanted me to go and meet those people like me, and I didn't want to meet them. This thing I had was too beautiful. I didn't want them to mess it up. And I still had some very peculiar notions about what kind of people they were going to be, and what they might be going to do to me, or say to me, or pray over me, or what have you. And I succeeded in putting this off for a good many weeks. Until finally, one day, the doctor picked up the phone when I was in his office, and he said, you are going into New York tonight. You'll go to such and such an address, and these people are taking you to a meeting. And that's what happened. You know, when I walked into that, well, in the first place, we went on the subway and met a couple of other people on the subway that were going too, over to Brooklyn. And they told me afterwards I was the most wild-eyed looking dame they'd ever seen. Well, I was. I was scared witless. I'd had a very nice dinner with three people. I could manage that. But I didn't know how many people were going to be where we were going, or again, what they were going to be like. And we got to this house in Brooklyn, and we went in, and it looked to me like there were dozens and dozens and dozens of people there. There weren't really that many. There weren't that many of us then. But I went upstairs to leave my coat, and I didn't come down. I don't know how long I thought I'd get away with it. But you know, a very nice woman came upstairs, and she put her arms around me, and she said, we're all waiting for you downstairs. We want you there. My name is Lois. And so I've always kind of felt, ever since, that Lois was as much my sponsor as Bill. Later that night, after I had attended the meeting, and after I had told the truth about my drinking without even thinking about it to all kinds of people I'd never seen before, It was perfectly extraordinary. I found it very easy to talk to these people, to tell them the truth. I wasn't afraid. And after the meeting was over, we all went upstairs to the upstairs sitting room, and we sat and talked till about 3 in the morning. And I asked questions, because by that time I almost knew the book by heart. Quite a few things happened that night that I think are the basis of AA. First, I knew what it was all about. I'd read it in the book. I had read the 12 steps over and over again. I knew them practically by heart. I had lots of questions about the techniques that were described in the book. Now, secondly, I had walked into a room full of strangers and discovered it was a room full of the closest friends I'd ever had. Here were people that knew what I was thinking before I hardly knew it myself. They could finish my sentences. I could finish their sentences. I was completely at home and comfortable with them. This was the fellowship of AA. This warmth, this friendliness, this thing that Wesley was talking about with he and his wife, it certainly is something that we have in AA, a kind of communication with each other almost below the level of words. We do understand each other in a way that other people don't necessarily. They have to work at it. With us, it comes naturally. And this was the greatest feeling that I could ever remember having, because I never remembered being part of a group that I really felt totally a part of. I always felt as if a part of me was standing on the outside looking in. Not here. This time I was all the way in. I had come home. I was where I belonged. I had found my people. This was the way I felt about AA the first night I went to a meeting. And that feeling has never changed. It has grown. The longer I have been in AA, the more I have traveled, the more AAs I've met all over many countries, the more closely a part of it I feel. I couldn't agree more with Wesley that going to meetings, remaining active, being a part of AA, an active part of AA, as far as I'm concerned, is a lifetime proposition. I've never heard of anybody getting in trouble who stayed active. I've never heard of anybody having a slip who went to meetings regularly. Maybe it does happen, I just don't happen to have heard about it. And I have a feeling that, well, there are two things about it. One is that if I spent the rest of my life trying to do everything in my power to help other alcoholics to recover, I could never repay the debt that I owe to AA. Two lifetimes would not be enough for that. And just recently, in another city, not my own, where I've been recuperating, I've been in the happy position of being able to go to 2 or 3 or sometimes 4 meetings a week. This has been going on now for several months, and I'm loving it. And naturally, most of all, I love being here with all of you. Thank you.
Marty, we're all very grateful to you for that marvelous talk. Now I'd like to ask our other lady trustee, Catherine Prince, to come up and lead us in the Lord's Prayer.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever. Amen.